The Woodstock Music Festival was 50 years ago this week. Let's take a look back with eight listeners from San Luis Obispo County who were there and have stories to tell. There's Peggy Atwill of Los Osos and BJ Sims of Atascadero. We'll hear from Ken Lidoff of Los Osos and Bill Seavey of Cambria. There's Alice McNeely of San Luis Obispo, Will Jones of San Luis Obispo, Gail Brooks of Los Osos, and Bill Wiener of Arroyo Grande. The following program represents the views and memories of the speakers and not necessarily the views or memories of KCBX, because these are memories of the late 60s and early 70s from people in their late 60s and early 70s. And you know that joke, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. Well, we're sharing stories from the Woodstock Music Festival from San Luis Obispo County listeners who were there and they do remember. Enjoy the journey back to 1969, or should I say, have a nice trip. Peggy Atwill started in California.
I was a student in Berkeley. I went to see my sister who just graduated from high school. I wanted to go to New York. I just read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Anyway, we got a ride with this guy in this Volkswagen from L.A. to New York, and we were going to share gas. Well, in New Mexico, he told us we had to, like, completely repair his car, and we said, forget it, let's hitchhike. So we hitchhiked the rest of the way to New York, and we made it there in, like, three rides.
Atwill knew some people and was one of the first to arrive at Woodstock.
We went up there a week early, and there everybody was. So there was this hog farm group that had come out to build the set, which was a cow field. I mean, it started out of this beautiful cow field. And then up on the hill from there, they built these food booths. But just down the road, there was like a little forested or bushy area, and these commune groups that had come to help put on the concert, and they were supposed to be like the security or something. It's so long ago, it's hard to communicate to people what it was like.
BJ Sims was living with her parents during the summer of 1969.
It was easy for me. I lived close by. You know, it's not like I hitchhiked across the country to get there. I was just home from college. I was 18 years old, really wanted to go to this festival. We had never heard of anything like this before, and just it sounded like a lot of fun. Well, my father is very conservative and was very strict with us. And I knew there was no way he would have let me go and spend the night. In fact, I really wasn't sure if he was going to let me go at all. Oddly, one of his also very conservative friends said, oh, George, let the kids go and have a good time. So I was going with my boyfriend. So no way I was going to be spending the night there. So with our shiny little tickets in hand that I believe cost $7, I have the tickets that we can look at. We started driving. It was about an hour and a half away and got there, and it was bedlam, absolute bedlam. You couldn't drive anywhere. You couldn't park. And so people were just pulling off on the side of the road and hopping on the hoods of cars or in the backs of pickup trucks. And everybody was giving everybody else rides and sharing food. But we really made more progress walking than sitting on the hood of somebody's car.
I had dropped out of college in the middle of 1968.
That's Ken Lidoff, who was on the East Coast in 1969.
Before I went to Woodstock, I was doing concrete work for my dad's friend's company. We just drove up there to Woodstock, and we were surprised when we got there. There was a huge line of cars going into that farm, and we were just one of them. It took, I don't know how long it took us to get from the back of the line into the festival, but it might have been hours.
Bill Seavey was a photojournalist in New York.
I was very fortunate. I went to journalism school at the University of Iowa, and I was offered an internship program. I ended up at Newsweek magazine and Popular Science magazine. So I went to my editors and I said, hey, there's going to be this big festival. Why don't you send me? And I'll shoot the heck out of it. And they said, no, I don't know. They were just not sure. I said, well, this is silly. I mean, this could be very big. So I decided to go anyway.
Alice McNeely didn't need to travel very far to get to the Woodstock Music Festival.
I grew up in Monticello, which was 12 miles from Bethel, where the site was. I mean, Woodstock was supposed to happen in Woodstock, New York, and then, you know, they had to move to a new location. So it was held on Max Yasgur's dairy farm. I went to high school with Max Yasgur's grandson and had been out to the dairy farm. So I knew the turf very well. The highways were really blocked. So I knew how to get there. The most profound memory is coming into the place and just walking down the road, and just there are people walking in both directions, and just how incredibly friendly everyone was and how colorful everyone was with, you know, hats and tie-dyes, and it was kind of beautiful.
I'd grown up in Philadelphia in the city, but I'd gone to college upstate. It was the summer between my junior and senior year, and that was the summer of Woodstock.
That's Will Jones.
Plan was to go to Woodstock one way or another once we knew it was going to happen. You know, it was interesting for me at that. I was 20 years old. Here I had my girlfriend and my younger brother and her younger brother. And so we were I was supposed to be the responsible one to make sure we all got home in one piece, take care of my little brother. I was surprised my parents let him go. So we wound our way up on back roads and found our way onto a two-lane that was leading to the festival site. And we began to see more and more people. And eventually we realized we weren't going to get any closer. And at that point, people were just pulling off into the fields and setting up their tents. And so that's what we did. And we had no idea when we pulled in. This was on Friday, the day the festival started. Had no idea how far we were from the actual festival site. So we parked, set up our tents, and then walked into the festival. And I'm going to say it was maybe a mile, maybe a mile and a half away. That first walk in was unbelievable because it was the Woodstock Nation. I mean, there were tents and there was all kinds of places that people were occupying during the festival, and all these banners flying and flags flying, and there was music everywhere. And so the festival was as much out where people were camping as it was actually at the festival site.
Gail Brooks lived not far from New York in 1969.
I had just graduated high school. I was 17. There was this wonderful music and arts festival, and that's right up my alley. I'm going to do that. I did not buy tickets for the third day because, much to my chagrin, I was going to meet my parents who were going on vacation in upstate New York on Sunday. And I actually went up by bus with a group of friends. And when I got to the so-called front gate, well, there really was no front gate. And there was just a bunch of people looking dumbly at a bunch of other people, staring back at them, and nobody took my tickets.
Bill Wiener was pretty close to the Woodstock Music Festival site.
I was working in a summer camp on the tip of Pennsylvania. A friend called from New York, and he said there was a music festival taking place that I want to go. He'd come pick me up. And we were right across the line from New York, and we got on this road, and a half hour later, we were in, now we weren't in Woodstock, because they wouldn't allow it. Originally, the festival was supposed to take place in Woodstock, because Woodstock was a big deal then. All the rock stars were buying houses in Woodstock. But when the city fathers heard of what these guys wanted to put on, they said, no, you're not coming here. So the guys who were producing this show, there were four of them. They were like business guys who just happened to love music. And they went hunting around. They found this guy, Max Yazger. And Yazger said, come use my farm. And in Bethel, New York, there's a place called White Lake. And that's where Yazger had his farm. And he said, come on, do what you want. And we drove up to White Lake, which wasn't more than a half hour away from where we were. Somewhere around, I don't know, maybe 2 miles, whatever it was, from the venue, traffic was just stopped dead. There were people renting you their front lawns for $5 or $10 where you could stick your car. Now all the front lawns were filled. They didn't know it, but they had 500,000 kids coming to this thing. That's a lot of kids. Everyone just stopped their cars and said the hell with it, got out of the car, grabbed their gear, sleeping bags and tents, coolers, whatever, and started just humping it towards this place where this music festival was going to take place. We just walked and walked and walked. You couldn't walk any further. We got to Yazger's field, and we couldn't get any closer to the stage because every square inch was taken up by someone who had arrived before us.
Bill Seavey arrived at Woodstock with his camera.
Anyway, I faked a press pass. I made myself a little press pass to get behind the stage. I got behind the stage, and you know, these guys, these bouncer types, were trying to kick me out all the time, but I refused to leave. And that was the only time I was actually in behind the stage, but that's when I got the best photographs of some of the stars like Joan Baez and John Sebastian. And I own the rights to the photographs because Newsweek didn't send me. They didn't use, you know, I didn't use their film. I didn't use their cameras, and I wasn't on their time. The next day, I could see that the story was more than just the stars. So I just started roaming the grounds, you know, with my camera. There were naked people swimming in a little lake or pond. I don't exactly know what it was. I took pictures of them. People were dancing and grooving and all that.
Alice McNeely already knew the farm and had planned ahead.
I was a Girl Scout. I came well prepared. I had food. I had water. I had rain gear. We had a tent. There, I remember walking by cornfields, and they were raising corn to feed the cows, and you know, all of the hippies were picking the corn to eat. It was cow corn. It wasn't really, you know, it was kind of tough stuff. It wasn't really designed for human consumption. But we had a lot of city folks that didn't know the difference. There were ponds that were used, I think, primarily for watering holes for the cattle and stuff, and people were swimming in them.
Bill Wiener was less prepared.
We didn't have any food. Well, of course, there was the cornfield there where everyone was running around naked. By the time we got there, they were already naked running around in the cornfield. There was you were supposed to pay to get in. There were supposed to be fences up. But these guys were so disorganized when they put this together, they had no money for the fences. It was either put up fences or build a stage. So they built the stage, okay? There was no fences. We just walked in. It was free. It was supposed to be $25 for the 3 days, which was, you know, considerable back then. But we just walked in, it was free. And we were about a half mile from the stage, and then we just plopped down. We had with us a pup tent. A pup tent is about 5, 6 by 6 feet, okay? You got five freaks in a pup tent, and it's getting later in the evening. So we're in this tent, and I peek out every so often, and I can just see this little sliver in the distance. That's the stage. We just eventually just fell asleep.
Peggy Atwell was with the hog farm.
Well, they had food booths up on this hill. They were completely overrun, and they had no way to get any more food because the roads were all blocked. So people were living with the food they brought with them or whatever was there. And the group I was in with the hog farm group and the pranksters brought some food in their big wild bus. But whatever we made, like I can remember one morning making, I don't know, maybe 500 pancakes and giving them out to whoever was there. And we'd make these huge things of brown rice. I mean, this was back in the day of eating healthy. And then people would show up with some kind of vegetables. So frankly, I don't remember eating much of anything except some of the pancakes I made and maybe some brown rice with some carrots or something.
B.J. Sams remembers.
I want to say Wavy Gravy and the Hog Farm were giving away brown rice and vegetables. It was just a wonderful atmosphere. All I saw were people who were happy and loving one another and smiling. Everything was out of order because the groups couldn't get there. I believe Richie Havens may have come on first because some of the other groups couldn't even get there. I do remember Richie Havens. That was very moving. He really sticks out in my mind. And then, of course, seeing him at Live Oak a few years ago before he died was really special.
Freedom, freedom, freedom.
Ken Litoff and Gail Brooks remember Richie Havens.
I remember Richie Havens going up there, and I don't know that I even had heard his stuff before. And he played so hard, he broke strings, and I think he hurt his guitar. I mean, he just was wailing on that thing.
I remember being surprised that Richie Havens opened on Friday afternoon because I don't think he was supposed to. And I think I've read later that it was a surprise to him, too. They just said, hey, whoever's getting here isn't here, so get up here. And that's when he sort of spontaneously made up the song Freedom, which was fabulous. He got the whole crowd's attention with that.
Peggy Atwell's experience was different because she was with the hog farm.
So when the concert started to happen, we were given these red ribbons with a little glitter pig on it, which was our backstage pass, our armband. I really felt like, wow, there's too many people. But I had this armband and I could go backstage. So I went backstage and I found myself a spot. If you're looking at the audience, I was on the left side of the stage. So pretty much for the whole concert, I stayed on the stage as long as I could stay awake.
Do you know who was there?
That's Ken Litoff.
This isn't a full list, but let me just read this off. The Who, Janis Joplin, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Jefferson Airplane, Joan Baez, Joe Cocker, Grateful Dead, Sly and the Family Stone, Ravi Shankar, Country Joe and the Fish, Richie Havens, Jimi Hendrix, all in one place. It was just so nonstop. I mean, it was one great group after another, after another, after another. I don't think our ears ever stopped ringing, I'll tell you that.
Will Jones had found a good spot in the audience.
It was close enough that we were able to hear and see the performers when it actually started, but it was a long way from front row. And it was possible you could kind of crowd your way down farther if you wanted to, but it was also a matter of kind of survival. I had my 15-year-old brother there. I'd kind of promised my parents that everything would be okay. Do I really want to be down that far, or would I rather just be in a comfortable place where there's some space and not just be in the thick of it and still be able to see and hear what's going on? So, yeah, we found a comfortable spot that first night and just settled in. At nighttime, it was spectacular because people were lighting little fires, and it kind of looked like a big encampment in various places, and people gathered around those. The highlight of the concert for me in the time that we were there was on Saturday, beginning with a series of bands that included the Grateful Dead and Santana. I would say without question, Carlos Santana's performance in Soul Sacrifice was, you know, one of the great live performances of a song ever. Carlos claims that he was not expecting to go on stage at that time and was under the influence of some kind of a psychedelic drug. And a guitar was a snake that he was wrestling with while he was playing it, but it seemed to work out okay.
Then I remember seeing Santana. I don't think I'd even heard of them before. And they just knocked me out.
That's Gail Brooks.
Later, I'm sure it was the next day at some point, I saw Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And they commented that they were nervous because they were playing together for the first time in front of a crowd.
Hello, Tess, 4965. Hi.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome with us Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
You know, most people aren't going to go, oh yeah, it was terrible, it was so crowded, and some of the bands, of course, had a very hard time getting in, and things weren't the way they wanted them to be, and some of them have said that it wasn't all that great for them. They couldn't hear themselves sing and things like that, but we were in the audience. We didn't have that experience.
Peggy Atwell, still on stage.
What happened was is that all these people started talking to me because I was right by the edge. So I ended up collecting these messages from the crowd and giving them to the guy, that Chip guy, who was reading it over the microphone. You know, your Aunt Sally needs you to call home or whatever.
Anyone who is with Shasa, please meet her in the front of the stage. She is lost.
That Chip guy? That was Chip Monk. And he was actually a lighting director who lit everyone from the Rolling Stones at Altamont to a Pope John Paul at Dodger Stadium. Amazing story, but at Woodstock, he was the master of ceremonies.
I went over there, sat in my little spot, took messages, gave them to the guy. I was there when Robert Plant and Pete Townsend singing and Abby Hoffman grabbing the microphone. That was some big episode that happened where he grabbed the microphone and Pete Townsend kind of hit him with it. neck of his guitar. And that I have to say, is the most violent thing I saw at Woodstock the whole time.
KCBX is taking a look back at Woodstock from the perspective of Central Coast listeners who were there 50 years ago this week. I'm Carol Tangeman.
Very interesting headline in the Daily News. Saturday, August 16th, traffic uptight at Hippie Fest. It's really exciting and probably one of the most frightening responsibilities that we have. We have the ability to gather this many people in this industry with the vibes that we have here present. This also gives us the responsibility, or forces it upon us, whether we really like it or not, to take care of us all. We're going to have an experiment in this phenomenon that no one else, I think, has ever had. Welcome yourselves to this experiment. We're going to hold announcements for a moment while we change over to other amplifiers in the sound system, because canned heat cooked them all. As soon as I find out, we will advise you whether the Mets won or lost.
As time went on, this was my little spot. I spent the whole time there, mainly because I wanted to hear the groups, and they were amazing. But also looking at the crowd, I'd never seen that many people. And in a way, it was kind of scary to see that many people. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was a total, as they say back in the day, a mind blower.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you please, would those of you who have taken up residence on the towers please come down? There are people sitting behind you who have the same right as you, who unfortunately cannot see. It would be greatly appreciated if you'd please come down. City McGee, or C.T. McGee, rather, please come immediately to backstage right. I understand your wife is having a baby. Congratulations.
Oh, they would announce everything from people being lost to some drugs being bad to babies being born.
That's Alice McNeely.
It was amazing that there were so many people there in an area that it wasn't prepared, you know, they didn't prepare for that many. And yet it was an incredible, peaceful venture. I do remember the helicopters flying over, news crews and bringing in artists and bringing in food. And the people in the local community, after the fact, I found out they were getting together and making sandwiches and things and sending them in, shipping in water.
We apologize for the noise of the choppity-choppity, but it seems there are a few cars blocking the road, so we're flying everybody in. I almost made the worst pun in the world about high musicians, but we'll skip that.
Will Jones talks about the music.
Janis Joplin and Sly back-to-back, and of course, Sly's performance was just legendary there. It's I'll never forget that. I saw him one other time, but there was nothing quite like seeing him at Woodstock.
Bill Wiener was about half a mile from the stage.
I don't remember hearing any music. Half a mile, and you can see in the distance, because we're up on a slope on a big hillside. You can see it in the photographs. But looking down, I can see the stage, but the stage is in the distance. I don't know, it's like 2 inches across, and there are little ants on the stage running around. But they have a big PA system, you know. They were using these big 50,000-watt Marshall amps, you know, and they had a whole bank of them. It was really something. Yeah, I bought the album. I bought the vinyl, and I saw the movie enough times. That's how I heard the music. But when I was there, I didn't hear Jack.
I'm Carol Tangeman. We'll be right back with more Woodstock memories from our Central Coast listeners who were there.
Winter had green. like yours, milady, like yours.
The Woodstock Music Festival had too many people, not enough food, and then rain.
It looks like we're going to get a little bit of rain, so you better cover up. Okay. All right, everybody, just sit down. Wrap yourself up.
We're in the tent, that's when it starts to rain.
That's Bill Weiner.
Because out of nowhere, it started to pour. We're laying in the tent, there's five of us in there. Every minute or so, someone sticks his head in the tent. You guys need weed? You guys want acid? I got it all. Say, no, we're good, man, get out of here. There's no room in here for anyone else. Everyone's trying to sell us weed. I could have gone for a steak sandwich. Somewhere around 2 a.m, I begin to realize that I'm lying in a puddle of water. The rain is sort of coming down into the tent, and there's five of us laying on top of each other. It was just a bunch of cave people, really. We were disgusting looking. We're just laying on top of each other, you know, in a heap, and we're all laying in about 3 or 4 inches of water on our backs, and I'm soaked, and I'm freaking miserable.
Peggy Atwill was better off.
I had a little tent with my sister that we had kind of made with plastic attached to somebody else's tent. I mean, it was this makeshift, ridiculous thing. But we stayed kind of dry during the storm, but it was this beautiful, green, grassy field. And then afterwards, it was this serious, muddy mess.
BJ Sems, as usual, was just enjoying herself.
It was raining, and we were sloshing around in the mud, and we were so far back from the stage that you could barely see.
You know, they had porta potties there. You know, you're kind of up a muddy bank, standing in the mud in line, waiting for your turn.
That's Alice McNeely.
Then there were tents set up for medical stuff, and the hog farm was doing food for people. And then there was the public PA system, which was quite entertaining, you know, giving us reverie in the morning to wake up.
Good morning. What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000. Now, it's going to be good food, and we're going to get it to you. It's not just the hog farm either. It's everybody. We're all feeding each other. We must be in heaven, man. There is always a little bit of heaven in a disaster area.
You know, the mud and the rain were uncomfortable. It would probably drive me crazy now, but I was young and was okay. I was with friends.
Bill Weiner and Will Jones reflect on the Woodstock Music Festival crowd.
Every one of us, all the same age, all in the late teens, early 20s, every one of us with long hair. And I looked around and I quickly realized that there were no grown-ups here. There were no parents here. There were no teachers here. There were no employers, no relatives, no uncles. There was no one here but 500,000 people who looked just like me. And I had no idea up to that point that there were so many of me out there.
I don't know what the average age was of the Woodstock festival goers, but I'm going to say the vast majority were in their 20s because, you know, you didn't trust anybody over 30 back in those days, so 30-year-olds probably didn't want to be at Woodstock. It's kind of funny to say that now that I'm 70.
Will Jones recalls.
I don't remember any security at Woodstock, frankly, and fortunately there wasn't much need for any security. In my mind, that's one of the great memories of Woodstock is that it was, you know, peace and love and music, and essentially that's what was demonstrated throughout the whole time. I don't remember any altercations of any kind. There may have been some, but I was never part of anything like that when I was there. So it kind of delivered on the message that it was trying to create there.
Yeah, I don't know that I, at the time I wasn't surprised. In hindsight, I was surprised that it was such a peaceful gathering.
That's Alice McNeely.
But, you know, it was the 60s that I think the people that were interested in coming went with the idea of enjoying music and having a good time, and they did.
Peggy Atwell had already been at the Woodstock Festival site for a week.
What police you could find that weren't completely worn out or covered with flowers of some kind or face paint. Because the chief of police of that town, he and his daughter had come to hang out with us early on before it even started. So he and the people of the town were really involved. They knew this was going to happen. The police were there. They knew that these people were obviously smoking pot and drinking beer out in the woods when they weren't working on building the set, but nobody was doing anything about it. And then when so many people showed up and it was just this overwhelming event, no one was even trying to do any of that. I know that health-wise, there were quite a few people who helped other people who were having a bad time. My sister, I know, helped in the health booth with people who were having some bad trips.
Ken Litoff recalls.
I went back to the restrooms at one time and I went over to see the people, and there was a guy sitting on the log, and he had two brown paper bags, like grocery bags, and he was saying, acid $2, mescaline $3. We didn't think the drugs were drugs back then. We thought that it was all, you know, this consciousness opening. I think that's changed so much, because now there's so much hard usage. It's not directed opening the mind. It's just, you know, a way to escape. But there was a lot of marijuana use. I mean, it was just a fog of smoke.
Those of you who have partaken of the green acid, if you would, as soon as convenient, please go to the hospital tent.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me?
Gail Brooks looks back.
When we were listening to this music as kids, we listened to it together in a room. Sometimes a pot smoke filled room, and, you know, whatever. But we didn't have separate earbuds, headphones. I've got Pandora. You've got Spotify. No, we were unified by the music. I really feel that that was one of the unifying forces. And of course, there was friends going off and dying in Vietnam. And those things really, I think, unified us in a way that it doesn't exist right now. It's more splintered off into this group and that group.
So now that Gail Brooks was at Woodstock,
the feeling looking around you, you suddenly realize that all this time growing up when you knew you were weird and you knew you were different, here was like all these people that are really in the same boat and really have a lot of the same thoughts and a lot of the same concerns. And to come together with a bunch of people in peace and love. I mean, we, I think, really all felt that this was a real something and this was a real unification. It showed what numbers we had and how we possibly could really change the world.
Ken Litoff and Bill Seavey each saw something extraordinary at Woodstock.
Well, you know, since then there have been trouble at festivals, and there's been a lot of commercialization of festivals, and this was just so wide open, and no one expected there to be a city of people. And then when we found that city, we all felt unified. We all felt like we were there for the same thing, which is just, you know, to listen to music and enjoy ourselves. We were all one. Everyone was smiling. They were high. They were happy. It was just music. And, you know, and love. So it was just that era.
You know, it was an era when people were trying to cooperate and show maybe another generation that we could all, you know, be peaceable.
Will Jones recalls.
Country Joe did his legendary Vietnam rag.
Give me an F!
And which got a little profane at one point.
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die.
But given the fact that it was during the Vietnam War and a lot of us were kind of the age where there was a good possibility if we weren't in school or had some kind of way to get deferred that we could be going to Vietnam or at least be drafted.
Those of you who insist upon taking residence on the scaffolding, I don't really know what to say. I assume if you were old enough to go away from home to get here, you're old enough to understand what we mean when we ask you to come down. If your determination was the same as your selfishness, we'd be able to have gatherings like this every week.
Max Yasker, the farmer who owned the land, went up on stage and spoke to the crowd.
I'm a farmer. I don't know how to speak to 20 people at one time, let alone a crowd like this. But I think you people have proven something to the world. This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place. We have had no idea that there would be this size group. And because of that, you had quite a few inconveniences as far as water and food and so forth. The important thing that you've proven to the world is that 500,000 kids, and I call you kids because I have children older than you are, 500,000 young people can get together and have 3 days of fun and music, and have nothing but fun and music. And I got bless you for it.
We woke up in our 10-man tents.
That's Gail Brooks, who would leave the festival later that morning to go on a family vacation.
It was early Sunday morning, and the Jefferson Airplane were playing, and they were my favorite band. I loved everybody who was playing, but they were my absolute favorite band at the time. And they were playing Volunteers of America, and I woke up to that. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm really in heaven. This is really happening. I'm in my snug little sleeping bag in the tent, listening to the Jefferson Airplane wake me up. How cool is that? I told my dad I would meet him at the so-called front gate, and so on Sunday morning. So here's all these cars going by. There's, you know, one car after another. There's people stuffed inside, and there were people on top of the car. Everybody that was leaving had to double up and triple up and be stacked in each other's cars because very few cars were getting through. So here comes my dad, and he says, "This is the first time I've hitchhiked since the Navy 20 years ago. This is kind of cool." And my dad bore a remarkable resemblance to Richard Nixon, who was president at the time. People are doing double takes as they're driving by. Like, here's this person who's obviously been to Woodstock and this guy that looks just like Richard Nixon. And so they're doing double takes. And so this one guy goes by, sticks his head out the window and says, "Sorry, brother." There's obviously no room in the car. And my dad, I kid you not, cups his hand in front of his face and says, "I'm not your brother."
Will Jones has had his 15-year-old brother with him at Woodstock.
We made a responsible decision on Sunday, which is why I know I did not hear Jimi Hendrix, because at a certain point on that day that we just decided it would be a good idea to leave early rather than try to deal with the continually bad weather and then also just how difficult it was going to be to get out of there. I didn't make a whole lot of responsible decisions when I was 20, but that was one of them.
Back again. You can leave if you want to. We're just jamming. That's all. Okay? You can leave or you can clap.
And then at the end, when Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner, it was powerful.
That's Ken Lidoff.
I mean, people were just crying and standing up and falling down. Even though people were, you know, radicalized or, you know, hippies or whatever you want to call them, just that feeling of, you know, that we are a nation and we're part of the United States nation really had power. And I won't ever forget that.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Thank you so very much. We've got one little last trip we'd like to lay on you, if it's at all possible. A couple of packages of garbage bags here. If on your way out, you wouldn't mind taking one, filling it up, and leaving it where you fill it, that certainly would be appreciated. Anything you can do to give us a hand to leave this area somewhat the way we found it, I don't think it'll ever be quite the same, but somewhat the way we found it, certainly would be appreciated.
Peggy Atwell was there till the very end.
At the end, when it was all over, they brought in all these U-Haul trucks to just throw in stuff that people had walked away from.
It's been a delight seeing you. Good wishes, good day, and a good life. Thank you.
You're listening to KCBX and our Woodstock 50th anniversary special. When we return, we'll take a look at how each of our Woodstock attendees carried the experience with them throughout their lives. We'll also learn how they ended up on the central coast of California. Stay with us.
Tell me, what's that you see? Marching to the fields of Concord. Looks like Hans and Johnny with his flintlock in his hand, marching to the Concord War. Hey, marching to the Concord War.
After the Woodstock Music Festival, Bill Wiener continued to protest the war.
I do believe that when all of us looked around and saw there were 500,000 of our own, I think it legitimized us and gave us some sort of political power, because we all came home from that, and that's when we really started protesting the war in Vietnam. I think it gave us a lot more courage that we had the numbers now to make a difference, and we certainly weren't going to change our hair or our jeans at that point once we saw that there were so many of us.
He and his wife worked in the entertainment industry in Southern California.
We lived in the belly of the beast in Los Angeles for 40 years. We did that. My wife finally said, "Let's get out of here. I've had it." So she went on Zillow, right? She found a little place overlooking the ocean in Arroyo, and that's where we are. I can see the sun go down every day.
B.J. Semmes also protested the Vietnam War.
You know, we feel that right now in our culture, we're very divided, and we are. We're so divided, and I hear young people say, we've never been this divided. And what I try to say to them is that we couldn't even talk to our parents back then about the Vietnam War. I mean, you couldn't sit at the dinner table and have a conversation about what was going on in our politics. It was horrible. It was wonderful for all of us who were together and, you know, fighting the revolution, but it was really difficult for families.
Semmes had a problem in her own family.
Another example of my very conservative father, when I told him that I was going to the March on Washington against the Vietnam War, he disowned me for a year. And he just said, if you do that, I will not pay for your college education. And I was in a very expensive private liberal arts college in Pennsylvania. And I just said, Dad, you do what you've got to do, and I'm going to do what I've got to do. And I got a job as a waitress. And it was scary. But I felt that it was something I really felt I needed to do. I stayed in my little college town all summer, and I worked a really difficult job as a waitress for less than minimum wage. But it was important to me that I stood up for what I believed in. And I think because he saw that, I stood up to him, and he saw that I was standing for something I believed in. And I think he respected that. He sent in the check for my tuition, and that was the end of it.
As for Woodstock?
I had one friend, when I just casually mentioned it, she came up and touched me on the arm. She said, she's much younger, "Can I touch you?" So what I have is the original envelope that my tickets came in. There's a little program. It's just black and white and purple, and it's the logo of the end of a guitar with a dove sitting on the end of it. And it says 3 days of peace and music. And this brochure is nothing fancy. It's just 4x8 piece of folded up paper that went in this envelope. And I have two tickets for Friday night, which was August 15th, 1969, which were never collected because there was nobody there to collect them. There was no gate to walk through. There was no fence to walk through. It was just pretty much pandemonium. And I have two tickets for Sunday night, which I was never able to use. So this sat in my scrapbook from high school these many years, and until my daughter-in-law framed it for me. So
Sems and her husband Turco moved to the Central Coast in 1973.
My husband Turco and I were living in Tucson, and I was in graduate school and needed to do an internship, and I was able to do that at Cuesta. And he wanted to start architecture school, so he was able to start at Cal Poly, and that's how we wound up in San Luis Obispo. Oh, yay, those many years ago. That was 1973.
Alice McNeely may have been a hippie.
I had gone to Washington and marched against the war. I mean, I was clearly against the war. My family would have called me a hippie. I don't know. I think the true hippies might not have considered that I fit. But I had some family members that were lifelong military people, and I remember it being a tad stressful. You know, at that time, there was a huge divide in our country between young people and older people who felt, you know, it was your moral obligation to participate in Vietnam, and a lot of us who thought we were there for the wrong reasons and we shouldn't. And I think it was emotionally a very tough time in our country. And maybe Woodstock was sort of a chance to let that go and just forget about it for a weekend and listen to music.
McNeely and her husband moved to San Luis Obispo.
We had ruled out San Luis Obispo because of the nuclear power plant, that which my husband really didn't want to be near. And then it kept coming back up. And finally, I dragged him because it was on my list. So I brought him here, and we knew within 15 minutes of being here that this was going to be where we were.
McNeely grew up near the Woodstock Festival site.
I've been back to the site. I was there here at Crosby, Stills & Nash in 2006. And it's a performing arts center, and there's a phenomenal Woodstock Museum there now. That's great to see. Very interactive.
After Woodstock, Bill Seavey wasn't ready for an office job.
Woodstock did, you know, have an effect on me that I didn't really want to work in corporate America. I wanted to live in a smaller town in a more rural environment. I went off and worked in Yellowstone Park. And it was kind of during the back of the land period, you know, that my generation went through.
Seavey now lives in Cambria, where he's a Woodstock memorabilia consultant. He learned recently that the Woodstock stage had been taken apart and used to construct paddleball courts. Then some guy recently really wanted that wood.
Seriously, this was only in the last year or something like that. He arranged to buy the paddleball courts, and now he's chopping up the stage into little pieces and putting them in pendants and in the display cases and this and that. And is, you know, he has a website to sell this stuff. I mean, if you'd had anything related to Woodstock, it would have value, especially the stage. I mean, even though it sounds kind of bizarre to chop up a paddleball court.
Peggy Atwill now lives in Los Osos. She's glad that Woodstock lives on.
At that concert, I really felt hopeful for our generation, for our country, and really for the world, because the world had kind of gotten smaller because of the men landing on the moon. And so it made me very happy. I was really happy that the consciousness around it and people talking about it and not just forgetting it or sweeping it under the rug or whatever, or minimizing it, that somehow that's been retained in the culture, in Americana.
Ken Lidoff's life turned in a direction that his parents disapproved of.
Both my parents worked for the government in Washington, and they weren't happy with, you know, me dropping out of school, which I did twice, and they weren't happy with the direction my life was going. When I went to college in the first place, I was pre-medicine, and they thought, oh, I was going to be a doctor. Well, 10 years later, I came out on the West Coast, and I ended up teaching woodworking, a little bit different.
Lidoff now has roots on the Central Coast.
Well, I hitchhiked back and forth across country once and ended up on the West Coast in 1972, and I've been here since then.
Gail Brooks has kept one Woodstock memorabilia item.
I have my two tickets in a sealed envelope. I don't know whether to break the seal or not. I think I'm going to frame them. I've looked in pictures, you know, people will bring me Woodstock books and you look in pictures. I've never seen myself in any picture.
Brooks moved to California from New Jersey.
I just had to go. It's town to town to town to town. There are no spaces, no spaces. Everything is next to something else. And I just couldn't live like that. I didn't even know any better. I didn't even know what I was trying to find, but I knew I had to get out of there. Basically, I thumbed out here like 2.5 times because the third time I didn't go back.
Gail Brooks' Woodstock experience informs her life today.
I still like to play music. I'm a music teacher. And I think a really big takeaway was also just the love that you could feel. I think it's just really important to love your people and by extension, everybody, because basically, we're all in this together, aren't we? And I think that that love was really palpable there. I mean, you, all these people having these feelings, it was a very, very noticeable and very feelable and very wonderful. And I think it's really the way we should all live our lives. So, you know, sometimes I do better at it and sometimes worse, but definitely it has informed me.
Will Jones has been a teacher and a principal at San Luis Obispo High School.
It gave me some credibility in the classroom when kids found out that I'd gone to Woodstock because the music from that era was still really popular and those, a lot of those bands were still playing, even though a lot of those musicians passed on pretty early. It was a good reference to be able to use, good experience, life experience to be able to bring into the classroom. And kids liked it when I talked about it. One of the things that I would tell my students was that it's very difficult to spend your entire life kind of living an alternative lifestyle, being off the grid. It may be possible for some people, but it's not really practical or realistic for most. But it doesn't mean that you have to give up your ideals. The ideals that became part of who I am in the 60s, I've carried forward all the way through my life.
Will Jones is philosophical about his Woodstock experience.
So I think, if anything, what Woodstock did was it helped to shape, it's symbolic in terms of shaping the consciousness of a lot of people from that time, what our values were and what was important to us. The ideals that I built back in those days are the ones that are still guide me in my life today.
Jones wrote a poem based on this newspaper headline.
Bob Weir visited New York recently to prepare for the Fare Thee Well Tour, the reunion, last performance, and pension plan for the remaining members of the Grateful Dead. New Yorker, June 2015. So when I read that headline, it just struck a chord with me. I had a kind of a flood of memories from those days. Okay, this poem is titled Fare Thee Well. Jerry, like so many others, long gone. We started counting with Buddy, Richie, the Big Bopper, and as time flew and so much turmoil raged, we added name after name, faster than our youth could fathom, steady loss followed by the flood. Otis, Brian, Jimmy, Janice, Jim, Dwayne, Barry, Danny, Pigpen, Graham, countless others, a hall of fame before a hall of fame existed. But I remember 69, the backyard hippie wedding on the Isle of Kew, the justice of the peace, five friends, a bouquet of tiger lilies from the neighbor's backyard, a bottle of champagne, a Yingling, a day-old birthday cake, new sounds of CSN on the hi-fi, a slow cruise through town on the hood of an old blue Falcon, waving our hands like flower child royalty to the puzzled citizens of rural Pennsylvania. Off a month later to a festival called Woodstock, $18 for 3 days of peace and music, weaving our way through leafy back roads across the New York border to Yasger's farm, inching down a two-lane lined with tribal tents and colorful banners waving above our nation. pulling off into a fallow field and setting up for song and celebration, the long walk to the sprawling amphitheater, the shock of seeing the love-buzzed army of freaks spread out from rim to rim, waiting for the first sounds to ring out and take us back to the garden. And here comes Tashikied, toothless Richie, singing Motherless Child, barring the open-tuned guild with that enormous thumb, and it was on. Carlos wrestling with the snake on Soul Sacrifice, Joe getting by with a little help, Sly taking us higher, Arlo flying in from Los Angeles, Janice taking another little piece of our heart, Jimmy ending it all in a daybreak purple haze. Rain, mud, bad acid, the hog farm, and Country Joe reminding us that more was at stake than loud music, free love, and a dime bag buzz, more than getting back to the land to set our souls free. Decades down the line, as the survivors of the 60s and 70s enter their 60s and 70s, the old bands still roam the earth like dinosaurs, mostly gentle herbivores now, the fierce carnivorous days receding in rear-view mirror as time and life force the go-fast, live-hard, die-young generation to slow down and reevaluate the precious present, the uncertain future. Which isn't to say we don't rock, turn it up loud, don't shake off the rust, don't feel that child of God feeling Joni sung about all those blissful years ago. So Bob and Bill, Mickey and Phil, rock on, and fare thee well, indeed, and let's all think of Jerry jamming with the dead on the banks of the eternal river. It's the same story, the crow told me, it's the only one he knows. Like the morning sun you come, and like the wind you go, and no time to hate, barely time to wait. Whoa, what I want to know, where does the time go? Come here, Uncle John's band, by the riverside, got some things to talk about here beside the rising tide.
You've been listening to KCBX and the Woodstock 50th Anniversary Special. We want to thank those who gave generously of their time. Peggy Atwill of Los Osos, B.J. Sems of Atascadero, Ken Lidoff of Los Osos, and Bill Seavey of Cambria. Alice McNeely of San Luis Obispo, Will Jones of San Luis Obispo, Gail Brooks of Los Osos, and Bill Wiener of Arroyo Grande. You'll be able to see their photos and listen to this entire program soon on our website, kcbx.org. All of the sound in this story, aside from the interviews, is from the CD Woodstock, 40 Years On, Back to Yasker's Farm, from Rhino Records. I'm Carol Tangeman. Thanks for listening.